This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Deborah Jackson Taffa's memoir, Whiskey Tender, covers her childhood in the 1970s and 80s, growing up in a Navajo border town. She witnesses a tumultuous period of racial discrimination and connects Native American history to family members' loss and grief. The Quechan and Laguna author balances the observations and emotions of her childhood with analysis on Native identity, religion, and growth. Deborah Taffa joins us for a discussion about Whiskey Tender after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's Missing Persons Task Force has not met since last summer, despite the state legislature funding the group for the next decade. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin reports the Department of Justice was delayed in hiring a lead position for the work.
State lawmakers last year passed two bills carried by Montana's American Indian Caucus to help missing and murdered people in Montana. But the state's Justice Department did not hire a leader for the task force until later this month and hasn't spent any of the funding allocated for training local search and rescue groups. According to 2023 state data, Indigenous people make up nearly 7% of the population, but make up a quarter of Montana's missing persons cases. Montana originally created an MMIP task force in 2019 to address the ongoing crisis. Now, with a full-time coordinator hired, the state is redoing the makeup of the group to run for the next 10 years. A spokesperson for the department said with the coordinator hired, they're in the process of appointing members and reaching out to tribes to nominate representatives for the Missing Persons Task Force. Montana's Department of Justice says it expects to have the group's first meeting this summer and then begin training search and rescue groups in the fall. For National Native News, I'm Ellis Julin.
Getting Native voters to the polls and tribal issues are among priorities of tribal leaders across the country. The Native vote was among topics at this year's National Congress of American Indians winter session in Washington. Andy Vigliotti has a story from Washington about tribal resilience despite concerns ahead of November's election.
As election 2024 heats up, many Native Americans are already feeling neglected. Michelle Downey is a tribal council member of California's Round Valley Indian Tribal Administration. She says candidates need to visit Indian country.
The thing is that nobody's coming to us to say what they're going to be doing to for us as a Native community. We're one of the largest reservations in Northern California, and we have 5,000 tribal members. So I would think that it would only benefit them when they would come to us.
Nationwide, Republicans have tried to unwind mail-in voting measures and have enacted more restrictive voter ID laws. Anissa Martin is an organizer with Indian Collective from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. She says new barriers only compound old struggles.
My res is like over 2 million acres, and transportation access is a huge thing with voting.
Martin says IDs matter.
I don't think they allow tribal IDs to vote, which has been a huge problem.
Genocide is on the minds of many Native youths who feel solidarity with the people of Gaza, according to NCAI Youth Commission co-president Yananawi Logan.
We cannot remain silent or pay no heed to the massacre in Gaza when our ancestors suffered a similar genocide.
Ashley Hemmers is an enrolled member of the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe. She says no matter who wins in November, tribes aren't going anywhere.
We always say at Fort Mojave we want partners that respect tribal sovereignty. So if you respect tribal sovereignty, that's what we're looking for. It'll make our consultation process easier. If you don't respect it, then it just means that we have a capacity gap and we'll either have to help you understand or wait you out.
For National Native News, I'm Andy Vigliotti in Washington.
The University of New Mexico is celebrating 20 years of offering a Bachelor of Arts in Native American Studies. An event will be held next week in Albuquerque to mark the milestone with the theme Looking Back, Moving Forward, 20 years of the Native American Studies Bachelor of Arts degree. The symposium will feature alumni to discuss how they're using their degrees. They also hope to inspire others to learn more about the program. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. In her memoir, Whiskey Tender, Deborah Jackson Toffa recounts growing up as a person from the Quechan tribe and Laguna Pueblo amid racial tension in Farmington, New Mexico. She navigates her parents' Catholic and Native traditions and an educational system that ignores her indigenous existence. It creates frustrations but also sparks a never-ending line of questions that she sets out to answer. Toffa connects important Native historical events to her family members' lives and explains how both triumphs and traumas reveal themselves in her daily life. Toffa is the director of the MFA Creative Writing Program at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe and the editor-in-chief of the River Styx Literary Magazine. And she joins us this hour for a conversation about her memoir, Whiskey Tender. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And she is here in our Albuquerque studio right now. Deborah, welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you here today.
It's so exciting to be here. Incredible.
Well, let's just get into it here, this conversation. I really enjoyed your book. I just couldn't put it down. And there's just so many great lessons, so many great life stories. I love a lot of the references to growing up in the 70s and 80s, as I did too, the television shows, the movies, the music. And just right off the bat, this book just hit a chord with me because at the very beginning, you have this picture of yourself as a young child. And I had a big wheel just like this
when I was about this classic age. Classic from that era.
They were everywhere, remember?
Yeah.
Well, you talk about your family, your parents, your siblings, and so let's just, I mean, when did this all start? I know you referenced in the epilogue that you'd had an idea of writing a memoir from the time you were a child, and a lot of times memoirs, you know, they'll deal with a person's childhood, but then they'll deal with middle age, and yours specifically is focused on from the time you're a young child until you graduate high school. Why that timeline? And again, just what put this all together?
They're just such formative years. You know, I think this is technically a coming of age book. So when I think of memoirs, a lot of times I think of them as being a sort of slice of life that deals with some sort of difficulty or tragedy, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be a period of time when a person's going through a divorce or a period of time when a person loses a job or is dealing with an illness. And we've seen some of those come out, I think, from Native writers. But I wanted to do something that was like a comprehensive look of how a Native kid is kind of born and kind of gets the feeling that something's not quite right in the country around them, you know, because your parents don't always tell you when you're a little kid, like all of the fraught history, and they don't talk to you about maybe the genocide. They try to keep you innocent because you're a kid. And, you know, you're watching TV, you're watching sitcoms, and you're seeing the world, and you can see that there are no Native people in any of those sitcoms. And over time, you start to kind of feel confused about how your family fits in the American experiment and the American dream. And, you know, I wanted to kind of portray the confusion and the fear and the kind of growing into the knowledge that our people have faced such tragedies at the hands of the government, and kind of to show that awakening and show how I survived it in a very fraught racist town in the 1970s and 80s.
Well, let's talk more about that, because your parents were from Yuma, Arizona, and you lived there as a young child with three of your sisters. And then in the early 70s, your dad gets a job with a power plant in the Four Corners. So you Right. move up to Farmington. And for our listeners who might not be familiar with Farmington in the mid-1970s, set that background for us and tell us, you know, what some of the challenges were.
Yeah, you know, Farmington is sort of a fracking oil town, coal. It's a lot of people from Texas came in. It's we think of Santa Fe and Albuquerque as being fairly liberal and Democrats, you know. Up there, it's Republicans, and, you know, it's conservative, and then it's what we would call a border town, right? So it sits on the Navajo Reservation, and there's a clash of cultures that becomes quite violent at times. And I would have to say that, you know, we were not unfamiliar with New Mexico as a family, because my mother's entire family comes from Socorro, New Mexico. And her father had moved them to Yuma for a job when she was a little kid. So, and my dad's mom was from Laguna Pueblo. So it was like, you know, we were having a sort of a homecoming, but of course we didn't go to Socorro. We didn't go to Poati where we were from. We went to this little town with a lot of conservative Texans and Mormons and Diné people. And I became essentially a minority Indian and a majority Native circle of Navajos and Texans. It was just a really confusing time where I didn't fit in anywhere.
Well, you write about that, how your family endured overt racism from the white people, but then in some cases you had issues with the Navajo people with regard to what they perceived as a lack of a cultural connection, being from a different tribe.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that, those dynamics. And I think for people that, you know, we're about the same age, so I can relate to a lot of those dynamics. Mm-hmm. But for people growing up now, I don't think they quite can really, because it's so common now for people to have different tribal lineages, right?
Right.
But in those days, it wasn't nearly as common.
No. You could be, my dad is 100% Native American, several different tribes, actually. But he was considered a breed as a kid because, you know, he wasn't full Yuma Quetzal. He wasn't full Laguna Pueblo. It was like, it was a big deal. And then when you have, you know, kind of the interior of the country, you have a lot of really big reservations where people have preserved their languages. And as a California tribe, we were straight up, we faced genocide out because the Yuma Nation is technically in southeastern California. You cross the Colorado River and you're in the city of Yuma. But California tribes have lost so much culture because of the politics of the gold rush, you know, and the governor said, go out and execute them so we can get the land, because he knew the gold was valuable. And so when you come from that sort of decimated tradition and then you move in, especially the Diné people, they have such strong culture, such strong language practices. We really did feel sort of a cultural cringe, like we didn't know enough about who we were as sort of mixed tribe kids.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in the 80s, which was not a very woke period. There weren't a lot of native kids who were kind of like now going back towards their roots. It was this weird age of Material Girl and Madonna and the rise of Trump and gold-plated buildings.
What I think is interesting about our generation is, so you had the Red Power movement in the early 70s, and then that kind of waned like by the late 70s and then throughout the 80s. And then within the last 20 years, we've had this whole resurgence. But our generation, like in the late 70s, in the early 80s, there wasn't the awareness. There wasn't young Native people. We were just weren't focused on issues like they are today. And I think it's so cool how you wrote about that. And you mentioned that the book is really about education and Native youth being emotionally affected by Western education and what that experience was like. You went to public school, you went to Catholic school, one of your sisters went to boarding school. Talk about that a little bit and just how that those educational forces also played a huge impact in your childhood.
Yeah, you know, no one teaches you anything about your people. We've been slandered to such an incredible extent. Like the general knowledge of who we are always has to do with our genocide. And so as a kid, you know, you go to school and I had these teachers that wanted me to read about the U.S. presidents, and it was the bicentennial, and everyone was all caught up in this sort of rah, rah, re, we're Americans fervor. And again, it was kind of a conservative era. And I just felt more and more slighted. Like I think Native kids do as you begin to grow up, you think, well, why does no one talk about Chaco Canyon? That's an incredible architectural thing that happened here in the Southwest, and there's evidence of it, but nobody talks about it. And, you know, when you do start to learn in school and public school about your own people, it's always at the juncture of tragedy that they start teaching it. They don't stretch back far enough in time to talk about like the great astronomical, architectural, botanical, you know, genius that existed on these continents. And so I think it was just incredibly discouraging. And, you know, when I looked at the bookshelves and I thought, I'm going to write this book. What is missing on the shelves? What was missing for me was a coming of age of a kid growing up in the 1980s who listened to The Clash on her Walkman and kind of endured all of that. You know, it just, it's not on the shelves. No. It's a book that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So then I thought, well, if I want to show kids how to survive this mess of going to school in the United States as a Native kid, I'm going to have to write about it so that they have a, you know, I wanted to give them an idea of how I didn't only survive, I came to thrive as an adult. Mm-hmm. But it was a grand feat to make my peace with this country and with the schools and the institutions.
Well, you're fearless in your approach because you lay it all on the line and you share a lot of intimate details about your childhood, about your family. And of course, the one character who's just this overarching pillar of strength and respect and admiration is your father. He plays such a huge role, and he has so many moments where he reflects and he shares these stories. But yet at the same time, he's just a hardworking guy supporting his family, dealing with life. And he has his own challenges that you talk about there in his career and just socially. So it's just so many just rich elements to this book that you captured so well. And one little side to you, you know, your dad was half Laguna Pueblo from the village of Puati. My family's from Puati. And you talk about your grandma Esther. Mm-hmm. I have a grandma Esther who's from Puati as well. Her name was Esther. Yeah, her married name was Esther Martin. And you talk about the railroad colonies, and your family was connected to the Winslow colony. And my family, we've got connections, of course, to the Albuquerque colony, but also to the Barstow colony.
Wow, yeah.
As well. So, yeah, when I saw that grandma Esther, and I was even, could this possibly be the same person?
Are we cousins? Like, that happens in Indian country all the time. Yeah, my dad is the backbone of the book because he's just such an incredible man. You know, he was one of 10 kids. Never got his high school education. He was tried and convicted of manslaughter as a minor at the age of 17 and just came back full force when he got out, met my mom, who was one of 15 kids.
All right. We're going to talk a lot more about your parents. We do have to take a short break. But anyone listening, if you'd like to call in and speak with Deborah Jackson Taffa, give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. The Fort Yukon Alaska girls basketball team just won their first ever state basketball championship. That's one of the big wins as we celebrate basketball tournament season. Who are your favorite Native teams making strides on the court? We're getting basketball highlights from around the country on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Archaeology Southwest. Did you know almost all major archaeological sites in the Southwest have been looted or vandalized? Looting and vandalism impact Indigenous people, past, present, and future. Every day, countless Native American cultural items are lost or damaged forever through looting and vandalism. Federal and tribal laws protect archaeological resources. More information about ending archaeological resource crime and how to submit a tip at savehistory.org and on social media at Save History.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and today we are talking with author Deborah Jackson Taffa. Her memoir, Whiskey Tender, just came out. She gives us a critical look at growing up in the 1970s and 80s in the Southwest, a time when the erasure of Native people and racial discrimination were still very much ingrained in schools and other institutions. Are you a child of the 70s and 80s? Do you remember the bicentennial when everything was red, white, and blue? We welcome your comments and questions. The phone line to our studio here in Albuquerque is 1-800-996-2848. So give us a call if you've had a chance to read Deborah's new memoir yet. Let us know what you think. 1-800-996-2848. And Deborah, your parents, yeah, they just have such an overwhelming presence in the books, or excuse me, in the book. Your dad, just so many words of wisdom, so much strength. And then your mom as well, just keeping that family together and her faith. And you conflicted a little bit with her with regard to faith and religion when you were growing up. But as you grew and you evolved, you came to appreciate and respect her perspective with regard to religion and spirituality as well. So let's think a little bit more about your folks. And I know you're prepared to read a passage. So please go ahead and read that. It has to do with your parents.
Yeah, I will say real quick about my parents before I read that. You know, they wanted us to do really well. They put a lot of pressure on us to do really well in this country. And I think that was some of the differences I had with them, too, was just that they really wanted us to achieve a lot. And it's a lot for any kid. When my parents left their wedding reception, Mom was sober. Dad, of course, drove. He sped toward 4th Avenue, the main thoroughfare in Yuma, cutting into the opposite lane on corners, fishtailing with a groom's finesse. Mom grew scared. She hiked up her wedding dress, reached her long leg over his thigh, and stomped the brake with her high heel shoe. The tires locked up. The car swung wide to the right before spinning them all the way around to the left, showing them the surprised expressions of people in other cars. It was like we were riding on the tilt-a-whirl at the Yuma County Fair, Mom said. The car slammed into the side of a busy downtown bar. The Plymouth's front end was mangled. Steam poured out of the radiator. It was a Sunday afternoon in April 1963, and the day was still light. Afternoon drinkers came flowing out of the bar's smoky interior like rice throwers out of a cathedral in a haze of incense and prayer. Being the eldest of 15 kids had made Mom conspicuous in this small town, and the bar was her father Juan's favorite, so some of the regulars and barflies realized she was a Herrera girl and wanted to know if she was okay. Sirens started up in the distance. A couple of biker chicks helped Mom out of the car, and she stood with them on the sidewalk in front, staring at the damaged headlight and hood. In her hurry to get out, she'd caught the train of her wedding dress in the door, and it had ripped. When she saw the torn fabric, she started crying. She told us, "I could see your dad through the window of the car with his forehead rested on the wheel, and I knew exactly what he was thinking." Dad was from the Yuma Reservation, across the train tracks and river, and he was worried the town cops were going to book him again. But when the cops pulled up at the accident scene and looked at Mom, plopped on the curb in a puff of white satin, mascara running down her cheeks, they decided to be merciful and let Dad go. Mom said they felt sorry for her because she was a good, local, Catholic girl who'd married a crazy Indian. When Dad walked in the front door and heard her telling us the story, he laughed and said she was wrong. He said the cops let him go not because they pitied her, but because Mom was beautiful and pretty people got away with it. He pulled off his black boots and lifted his holy socks onto the coffee table. He put his arm around her and said getting away scot-free on their wedding day was the first sign Mom's charm would work magic in his life, like a lucky rabbit's foot or a powerful tattoo. He reminded Mom how romantic he'd been at their wedding, how he'd refused to let her sisters decorate the car with do-it-yourself flowers because the phony tissue paper looked too common for a woman of her caliber. Instead, he and his brothers had performed a top-secret midnight operation, sneaking into St. Thomas Indian Mission's garden on the reservation, where they cut a bunch of roses to string over the roof of the car. Mom groaned, "Don't brag about stealing from the church." But the two of them laughed, and Dad went in the kitchen to grab a snack. Mom's protestations never fooled me. She loved the memory of the stolen roses, as well as Dad's claim that her beauty swayed the cops. But what made her light up especially was the way he called her his lucky charm. This is how my parents twisted bad things around, seeing the appearance of events in a funhouse mirror, stretching memories tall and pretty when they were really goofy and squat. They knew a story could be told in various ways, and this is how they chose to shape theirs and how they would teach me to shape mine as well, by molding their wedding day car accident into their first blessing as a couple.
I really like that one, Deborah. I also like that passage when you have a problem at school and your parents, you all go to dinner there in Farmington.
At the Pancake Alley.
Yeah. And your dad's like having a little bit of issues with the waitress there. And, yeah, just so many amazing moments. Well, let's talk about the title, Whiskey Tender. Where did that come from?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to reclaim a lot of pejoratives in this book. You know, when you hear the word whiskey, it feels in conjunction with Native people. It doesn't feel like it goes with the word tender. My family was problematic, but it was also absolutely a tender family. And, you know, there are a lot of pejoratives that I'm trying to reclaim. A lot of people think of Native American people as being wards of the state, unable to better their own circumstances. That has never been my experience with Native men, especially growing up. All my dad and, you know, a lot of men that I saw around me, Navajo men, they worked like three jobs. They worked in the coal mines. They worked in hard, hard labor to try to get their family ahead. So just trying to turn a lot of stereotypes around.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a caller. We have Jen, who is listening online in East Texas. Hello, Jen, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. I am so excited about this book. I was going to get online and order it right away, and then I heard you say you I thought I heard you say you might give one away, and I'm like, oh, my God, I have to have this book. I buy so many books all the time from all the marvelous new authors we have coming out, and as a Cherokee person myself and growing up in the 60s, it wasn't like the 80s, but you know, it's very, you know, it's just very different than what our parents and our grandparents grew up with, but it's still a challenge. And this book sounds like so much fun as well as a challenge. I'm just really looking forward to it. And I want to thank her so much for all the effort that she's put into this book and having us enjoy, you know, similar youth. So thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to this book.
Thank you. It's awesome.
Yeah, thank you, Jen, for calling in. Unfortunately, we won't be giving out books on this show today, so listeners, please don't call in asking for us to send you a free copy today. All right. But yeah, so I think this book just hits so many chords and connects with so many folks. And again, going back to Farmington, New Mexico, Farmington has that long, sordid history going back to, you know, when the oil workers really, the oil fields really exploded. Lots of turmoil, lots of racial tension. Do you go back often? And if so, do you think it's changed? Do you think it's improved since when you were growing up?
I think it's changed. I hadn't been back for a very long time, but I went last week for a book event at the library, which was really wonderful to see that they had brought in, they're trying to bring in a lot of diverse authors. And, you know, the town has people who have moved in from California and people who have left because the power plants are shutting down. As we move from coal-fired power plants to different forms of energy, that's going to be inevitable that rural America kind of gets a little bit emptied out. But, you know, Santa Fe is quite a different world, and that's where I live now. I live in Santa Fe for my job at IAIA. And so, you know, I can't really speak to current events in Farmington. Back in the day, you know, it was a difficult enough environment that the government sent in the Civil Rights Commission to kind of straighten things out and calm down the different sides, you know, because there was some pretty brutal killings of young Native people in the city when I was growing up there.
What about just being Native today, growing up today, being a teenager today in 2024? Like we talked about earlier, you know, our generation wasn't really dialed into issues like young people are today. We didn't have as many progressive mindsets. But do you think it's gotten better for young Native people today as compared to what it was 30, 40 years ago?
I think it can swing the other way. I think it's better right now, but I think, you know, societal pressures, they're very real on activists. So, you know, a lot of people think it's easy to be a social activist. It's not that easy to be a social activist if you've been thrown in prison for protesting or if you've seen somebody injured or hurt beat up, you know, and that was the brutality that my father's generation grew up with pre-civil rights. That was sort of the dangers that I grew up with. My parents were always emphasizing that we should be very careful, that, you know, we know that missing and murdered Indigenous women, that's a whole thing kind of goes hand in hand a lot of times with oil field workers, men in trucks. I would hide, you know, when I was out hiking around Farmington, when I was out in the land, I would hide if I heard a truck coming because I knew that it was dangerous. And the other thing that's different for young kids today is they have parents in our generation who have gone to college and are fairly educated. My mom and my dad didn't finish high school. You know, neither of them finished high school. My father took his first, well, my mom and dad both took their GEDs when I was in high school. And my father just took his first college class at Thana Othum Community College at 81 years old. He is currently in his third community college class. He's taking Apache history. He takes one a semester. So we're very, very intellectually curious people, but we didn't have the advantage of formal educations. My dad's older brother, Gene, actually went to Indian boarding schools. We're just a little closer to the trauma of really strong assimilation policies that were meant to rob us of who we were. And so, you know, that's the sad thing in publishing is that we have a lot of older generation authors, Leslie Marmon Silko, Louise Erdrich, they're all kind of Simon Ortiz. They were this first Native Renaissance, and then there was sort of a gap when the only person they really published in our generation was Sherman Alexie. They had their one Indian in publishing, I guess is what they thought. Now we see a resurgence where a lot of younger generation people are telling their stories, and that's fabulous. That's what I'm trying to develop. But there is this sort of empty space in the 70s and 80s. And people like me and Ramona Emerson were trying to fill it, but we may never get caught back up. And I blame that on the big New York publishers. Like, why did they only publish Sherman for so long? I think they think one Indian story is like all Indian stories, but that's just not true. You know, the Pacific Northwest has a very different culture than we do here in the Southwest, than they do in the Northeast or in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. We need a lot of books. We need narratives and counter-narratives coming out of Native country.
That is so true. And I hadn't thought of it that way, but I very much feel like I'm in that void. Like, I love a lot of Native authors, but I do feel like, and that's, I think, why your book resonates so powerfully with me, is because it is that voice from that generation that you say is just not represented nearly as much as some of these other perspectives. And another aspect of your writing that I really admire is your ability to just tell these really cool, poignant family stories alongside like these really significant historical issues and events. And there's, and I learned a lot. I mean, you talk a lot about Laguna history. You talk a lot about like the early 70s, the Red Power movement, but there's also, you talk about a protest that occurred at a Dodgers baseball game in 1976 when these protesters, Native protesters, went out there and burned a flag. I had never heard of that in my entire life. I was a big baseball kid when I was growing up, too.
Did you look it up?
I did. I looked at YouTube and everything. Talk about that a little bit. Share that with our listeners.
Yeah, it's just, you know, we, you and I both were born kind of at the end of the hippie generation, that we probably would have fit into that a little better than we did the 80s, right? So I was watching baseball with my dad, and yeah, these two Native people who were protesting healthcare issues in Native country, you know, we don't have access to Indian hospitals if we're living, for example, in Kansas or Missouri sometimes because we're so far from our homelands and it's not fair. We're supposed to be given health care, free health care with our treaties. I think, you know, those kind of protests and everything, I can't remember exactly what your question was again. You're just asking about the...
Yeah, for folks that weren't familiar with that issue, those two Native protesters who went out and...
I mean, I think it was just very common in the late 1970s because we were in that generation of protest. It was a time of civil rights movements. And then it kind of waned and it went away for a while. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, there's the zeitgeist that you're grown in and it's not your fault when you're grown. But to be the vocal, bullheaded, kind of outspoken kid that I was in the 1980s, it took some strength. It took some guts. I wasn't singing with a choir of kids necessarily. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because politically, the Republicans were in power and it was a very conservative era. In terms of braiding the personal stories with the historical, That was a really difficult thing to do. I think a lot of people, when they think about a nonfiction book, they're thinking like a history book that is kind of a dry presentation of facts. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something like Reservation Dogs Meets the Southwest. You have, you know, suicidal kids, you have tragedy, you have all kinds of issues, people trying to rise up societally and get better jobs. You have everyday struggles. But then I wanted to weave into my family stories like a broader picture of America's history as it pertains to Native American people, because I think a lot of Americans are ignorant of our history.
And what kind of feedback are you getting, Deborah? The book's been out for a few weeks.
Oh, it's been fabulous. This week, last week, Esquire magazine called it an instant classic, and they named it one of the top memoirs to be published in the country so far in 2024. And I was like, I'm happy with that. And then a few days later, Esquire put out another article that was the best books, nonfiction and fiction, novels and memoirs, the best books of 2024 so far. And they picked 15, and me and Tommy Orange both had our books on that list. Oprah Daily picked it as one of her top memoirs of 2024 so far. Elle Magazine, The New York Times, Publishers Weekly. I just won a National Endowment of the Arts in prose based on some of the pages I submitted from this book and the next book. So there's, I have a two memoir deal that I'm working on. So there's a second one coming up. But yeah, you know, the thing is that Some people are saying that it's an indigenous memoir, and I was really grateful to the Washington Post because they said, you know, some reviewers are calling this an indigenous memoir, but it's an American memoir, mm-hmm. full stop. And I think as a country, until people from all different cultures understand that the ground we stand on, that the foreign policy our government uses, all of it began with us, we're never going to see ourselves clearly. And that's an embarrassment as a country not to know your origin story.
Deborah, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to take another call, and we're going to talk more about your book and your career. Stay with us, listeners.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects authentic American Indian and Alaska Native artists and craftspeople and their art and craftwork. Under the Act, it is illegal to market art or craftwork misrepresented as American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native made, or as the product of a particular Indian tribe. Reporting potential act violations can be done at doi.gov/IACB or at 1-888-ART-FAKE. Support provided by Indian Arts and Crafts Board.
You are listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and there is still time to join this conversation with author Deborah Jackson Taffa. We're talking about her new memoir, Whiskey Tender. It was just released and is raking in accolades from fellow writers, book reviewers, and readers. Our number here at the Albuquerque studio, 1-800-996-2848. And let's take another caller right now, Trenton, who is listening on KUNM in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hello, Trenton. I understand you're an IAIA student.
Yeah, Sam on the Baluakinhi, Nipeta Ee. Hi there, everybody. My name is Trenton DeVore. I'm actually an ILS major here on campus at IAIA. I'm with my son right now. We're listening in. I had a question, for Deb, especially as an author and as an educator, you know, how do you maneuver these spaces and like colonial paradigms and, you know, uplift indigenous pedagogies? You know, I feel like that's always been like a difficult thing for me as well to really maneuver these spaces. But I feel like IAIA has been doing a really good job at, you know, decolonizing and recognizing and reclamation and rematriation that comes into a lot of like what is education. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that too as well.
Yeah, I when I was in my university years, I wasn't fortunate enough to go to a school that, you know, had a indigenous tribal president, provost, dean, teachers, like an indigenous run institution. And it was incredibly difficult. I, in fact, disidentified with the goal of getting a degree for a very long time. I didn't go back to get my undergraduate degree until I was 35 years old. And I didn't go to graduate school until I was 40 years old because I was so disgruntled with the institution and so burned by the fact that they never taught anything useful about my people. So in my program that I direct, the MFA in Creative Writing program, I tell people that to me, Indigenous knowledge means that you have a sense inside of yourself what you need to learn to survive and thrive. And so I ask my students to build their own reading list, and they present it to their mentors with whom they're going to work with that semester. And the mentor might tweak it or make suggestions of other books. But there's some sort of aspect of self-drivenness in it, right? You go out and you seek what it is you need to know, understanding that you have a small voice of wisdom inside of you. And ultimately, you have to decide for yourself what it is you need to learn and therefore to teach. Because we teach best what we learn, right? Mm-hmm. So I just think that being at IAIA and being in a community that has an Indigenous value system, understanding that when I step into a university that's a state university and I'm dealing with non-Indigenous people, that that is a product of the first university in Bologna in Italy, you know, that I'm a guest there. And I'm not shy about reminding people, you are my host in this institution. My Indigenous elders had a different model for what they believed education was. You have to you have to make sure that you call people out on their sort of their sense of you know, it means something in most cultures to say that we're a host and that somebody's our guest. And so when I've been in very white spaces and I have felt people that they were being slightly difficult with me because of my background, I would remind them of that, you know. But fortunately, at the Institute of American Indian Arts, I don't have to, because we're all sort of coming from diverse perspectives, but similar in terms of the respect that we afford women and that we afford youth. And I hope that, you know, I know that we're not perfect, but I hope that students who attend our school can see that that vision is Indigenous.
Deborah, speaking of the MFA program there at IAIA, I know Tommy Orange is also one of the mentors there. Yep. And one of the teachers. And he gave a review of your book on the back of the cover. Yep. And yep. And we just had him on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about his sequel to There that just came out.
Wandering Stars.
Yep. Yeah. So talk a little bit about just working with Tommy and some of the other students.
Yeah, you know, it was really great when I came into the program. Tommy had already graduated. And so one of the first things I did was I met with all the mentors and I told them my vision. And my vision is that we don't have a scarcity mentality. I don't want there to be competition in the system. And we don't want there to be only one Native person being published anymore. You know what I mean? Like I talked about that period of time where it's really easy for the publishing world to say, we have our diversity because we have our one or two or three Native authors and we're going to push them ahead and make sure everybody reads their book. And that's enough for everyone. The truth is that we have over, 500 tribes, federally recognized tribes in this country with vastly different traditions, languages, arts, all of it, you know? And so you can't say that because you have one regional author that you are representing all of Native America. So what we need to do is we need to be publishing as Native people at the same volume that other cultures are publishing. We have a million books written by white women who've been through divorce or a white guy who's looking for a new job. You know, we just have. Mm-hmm. And we can't say that the field is flooded and we need to be generous with each other. And the thing I like so much about Tommy is he's all in with that vision, like we all are as mentors. I have worked with the greats. I mean, we have Brandon Hobson, Bojan Lewis, we have Danielle Geller. We have a lot of amazing, amazing authors. And the generosity that they bring to their students and the sort of feedback that they give them that your story is necessary, your story is unique. Because we are all writing from different generations, from different genders, different genres, me and Tommy, because Tommy's working in fiction and I'm working in nonfiction. And when he read the book, I think he was really surprised. He was like, oh my gosh, this, because it reads like a novel.
It does.
And a lot of times people don't think a memoir can read like a novel, but I built it to be something that had some dark humor and some fun, and it was meant to be engaging, and there's tragedy. But it's really powerful to me politically to say these things actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Deborah, earlier you mentioned just the publishers not being supportive enough. And do you think that's the main challenge that we face with regard to just having more Native authors being published? Or are there other issues as well at work here?
Well, you know, we need a more diverse literary ecosystem. So if I tomorrow said, rather than working with my agent, who I really love her, she's wonderful, but if I wanted to find a Native American literary agent to represent me, there isn't one. In Canada, my friend Billy Ray Belcourt, he has a Native literary agent. We need Native American literary editors, line editors, publicists, marketing executives. We need people in the publishing houses. We have right now a lot of very wonderful Indigenous professors working in MFA programs, helping students who are writing creatively. But we don't have people in the industry itself that are there to kind of, and you know, that's hard. When the gatekeepers, none of them understand the story that you're trying to tell, you know, you have to get everything perfect. I did not sell my book until it was basically done because I didn't want anybody to manipulate what it might be. You know, there are a lot of ethical considerations when you write a memoir. You have to ask yourself, why am I exposing personal family stories on national stage? Why am I telling things about my family that are relatively private? In the end, for me, infusing the history and the wrongheadedness of governmental policies was a way of saying, well, perhaps this book becomes an indictment, an entertaining indictment of the U.S. government. That's the only reason to do it.
Yeah, right. Let's take another caller, Freddie, who is listening in Chinle, Arizona on station KUYI. Hello, Freddie, and welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Glad to hear the subject. I'd like to just kind of interject. I'm 7 years old, and I got a similar story that's kind of parallel the author, which I would like to get the book sometime and look for it. I grew up in the state of Kansas, and my folks are from out here, from the Navajo Nation. They were sent to school there, I guess, by the United States government. And I grew up there. And so I have a kind of a different perspective on things, too, as well. And I like to say, though, mine has been pretty positive. I have heard the conditions even there at Farmington. And, of course, we've come every year out here since before I was born. So I have a direct connection in that regard. And also I have a different connection growing up in the Midwest and dealing with Oklahoma in this too as well. So I just wanted to interject that. So I don't know if you have a question to me. I would appreciate that.
I will say this to you, Freddie. I think it's wonderful that you talk about this sort of migration story that your family lived, because I think a lot of Americans know about this great black migration that happened after the Civil War, where black people moved from the South to the North. But very few Americans know that there was a great indigenous migration that took place because of the Indian Relocation Act or Public Law 959. My father was trained as a welder and moved off reservation as an assimilation policy. And a lot of families in my generation went through that. I think in the 1940s and 50s, like 85% of Native American people lived on their home reservation. And by the 1980s, that number had flipped. It was like maybe 40% or 30% of Native Americans lived on their home reservation because of this great migration. And so we don't always think of Native Americans as being people who have a sort of immigrant story or a migrant story, but we do. And it's something that is a thread for sure in my book, is that displacement.
Thanks for that call, Freddie. And Deborah, let's go ahead and click ahead to the present now, and let's talk about, because now you are a parent, you're also a grandparent, and these stories that you share in your memoir, are these stories and is this family lore that you've shared with your children in the past, or are they just now learning it from the book?
No, they know about it, yeah. You know, they're reading it now, and they're saying, well, this is fleshed out more than I knew that these things happened, but it's fleshed out. And my grandkids, of course, they're too little. They're half Native Hawaiian. They're 6 and 4. And someday they will read the book, but they can't obviously yet. But, you know, I have to say, I wrote this book as an Indigenous mother, and it's hard to be an Indigenous parent in this country because you can't count on the schools to teach valuable things about your culture. And so you're always going in and trying to re-educate the miseducation. And like my grandson was the head speaker in the Lincoln Day Parade out on Oahu recently, and I was helping him memorize his lines at Christmas, and he's thinking Abraham Lincoln's a hero. And I'm wanting to think, you know, well, when will I tell him that Lincoln killed 38 Dakota warriors in the, you know, greatest mass? And that's the thing is, as a parent, when do you break your kid's heart? As an Indigenous parent, when do you start to tell them the truth? And that's one of the big tensions in the book between me and my mom and dad, is they sort of kept those secrets too long because they believed in the American dream. They believed in a meritocracy. My dad said, you can pull yourself up by your boots, regardless of the poverty we come from, and you can make a better life. And look, it was true. He did. But I think they maybe waited a little too long to tell me the deeper, darker truths about America. And when I figured it out myself, I got kind of angry.
Well, at one point you talk about being a big fan of Andrew Jackson until you, you learn the history there, right?
That's so dumb. That's exactly what I'm talking about. When you're an immigrant or a migrant into a new country, you don't know what's going on in that new country. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are a lot of foibles and stupid little mistakes and silly problems that my sisters and I create for ourselves because we are like strangers in a new country once we move off reservation, and we don't have our gazillion cousins and, you know, 24 uncles and aunts to help us out.
And what about your siblings and your dad? What do they think of the book? Are they, hey, I don't remember it like that? Or what are you talking?
Yeah, I put a disclaimer at the end of the book that said if I got anything wrong, that it's my fault. But we know that memory is subjective. Mm-hmm. And they know that the through thread of the story, it's our family story. They know that. We quibble over the number of puppies we had. My father told me, you got a few things wrong, but overall, he really loves the book. My youngest sister has been really profoundly affected in a positive way by the book. And my oldest sister is a little bit irritated by some of the portrayals. So, you know, that's a scary thing, and it's hard. And I want them to know that I love them. And I wouldn't have written this book if I didn't think that there were Indigenous kids out there that really needed it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what's in store. You mentioned a second memoir. And then just what all do you have going on with regard to promoting this book?
Yeah, this book, I'm heading out tomorrow to Cal Arts in Los Angeles. I have the Annapolis Book Festival, the San Antonio Book Festival. I'm giving the keynote panel with Natalie Diaz and a couple of other writers at the Northern Arizona Book Festival. I will go back to my alma mater in Iowa City. I got my MFA in Iowa City. I'll go back there. I'll go to St. Louis. So there's a lot of travel ahead. I have a novel that is in process, and then I also have about 30,000 pages of the second memoir. And I'm a little superstitious about talking about those before, you know what I mean? Because it's like, I'm going to jinx myself and I'm never going to publish anything again if I talk about it.
And you've got this magazine, River Styx, and I like that title because I took Latin as a kid, and I know that's the mythic, in the underworld, that was the mythical river. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, I got moved out of, let's see, I lived on the Fort Yuma Indian Reservation between the ages of 26 and 29. Then I came back to Albuquerque and I lived in Rio Rancho, and I was there until I was about 32. Then my husband got a job offer in St. Louis, Missouri, so we moved to the state of Missouri. And when I got out there, I learned that there was a law in place. It was illegal to live in Missouri if you were even a quarter Native American until into the 1900s. I don't know how strictly they followed it, but it was on the books. So I quickly became sort of like a social activist, and I was a board member on the Missouri Humanities Council, and I was instrumental in introducing a Native American heritage program in the state. And from there, I got involved. I went back to college, so I was 35 years old as an undergraduate in St. Louis. And I began publishing around that time. And then I was drawn into this River Styx literary magazine sort of as a volunteer and then a board member. I had financial problems. It started to fall apart. And pretty soon I was the only one standing holding the bag. So I rebuilt it over the last year and a half. And it's moving towards diversity and trying to publish some new voices.
All right. Well, Missouri. I'm going to remember that because I have a sister who lives in Missouri, and I'm going to let her in some of that sordid history there in the state. Unfortunately, we are now out of time. We're going to have to wrap up our show and our conversation. But Deborah, sister, thank you for coming in and sharing your gift with not just our listeners, but the entire world.
Very impressed with your studio. Thank you so much.
You bet. You bet. We're going to wrap it up now, folks. But please join us here again tomorrow for Native Basketball Highlights. How did your local high school basketball team do? Who are you rooting for during March Madness? Let us know. Join us tomorrow here on Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Orik mashat or ibdak mashat. New put at the go ibdak, mamdam sapo gugu sidat. A mashaka paichum bohimat, pihai chochuk for that amok gudu the duck. Ibdak mumkidak, pom some chugum famira. Am go wom nyoka gugu dab, amjadak of famira, doki. Paichas machi bab amjad, moniga, mama came up on mea, amonig healthcare.gov. Amoya gugu, the mamako gigi, sikor, like hamako gigi, go kutus homok jud. Idop amjad him of Medicare to Medicaid hachipkan.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.